You're listening to the Apple Insider Podcast.
Welcome to episode 51 of our show, where we discuss the latest news about Apple, iPhone, iPad, Mac, Apple Watch, Apple TV, and more. We're recording on Thursday, January 14th, 2015. I'm Victor Marks, and joining me are Neil Hughes.
Hey guys, how's it going?
And Shane Cole.
What's up?
So, Shane, you were telling me before we started recording that Apple Music has 10 million paid subscribers in 6 months.
That's the report.
What should we know about that?
The interesting thing is that there are 10 million people willing to pay for music, I suppose. I guess secondarily, though, it's that they did it much faster than Spotify did. And I don't know if that's because Apple is much better at selling this kind of stuff, or if it's because the market is shifting and people are okay with subscribing to music for $10 a month. But they did it, and they did it really quickly.
So it took 6 years for Spotify to reach that. Is part of that just the fact that when Spotify started, it was a totally different world?
I mean, I guess part of it could be that. That's what I'm saying. There's no really way to know why it went so fast. You know, it could be that the world is just changing and people don't want to buy, except for Neil, people don't want to buy their music anymore. it could be that Apple just has a much bigger soapbox to stand on and shout at people. Spotify didn't have, you know, Pharrell hosting a show on its subsidized internet radio station.
Do you think that the free tier hurts Spotify for people like me, that I only run Spotify on my desktop and I use it to sample an album in its entirety before I buy it, but I will never pay for Spotify? I just listen to the ads.
Well, back in the day, I want to say there was a bigger gulf between the free tier and, yeah, there was, because there's a limited amount of time to listen to the free tier, right?
Right.
When Spotify first started, you can only listen for so many hours a month, which, like Pandora used to be. Back then, you might be right. The change to unlimited free ad supported streaming may have been something that dragged their subscriber numbers down. But I mean, they've kept growing.
I just wonder if that's holding them back. Especially when you look at the approach that Apple took, which is to say, instead, you only get 3 months and then you got to pay.
Yeah. Well, there's also the question of what do the audience demos look like, right? Because when you have people like Taylor Swift that aren't on Spotify, and if the audience demo is super mainstream and poppy, then they're going to go where Taylor Swift is, regardless, I think, of the cash. Because they're either going to go to YouTube and stream it, or they would have bought her album on iTunes or whatever if they couldn't stream it from Spotify.
Yeah, but to go back to your earlier question, Victor, I think it's just the demographics of the market have changed. It took Spotify a while just because people were more accustomed to buying music. And now that these subscription services are catching on and people realize they can actually, you know, save money doing it this way or just have it be more convenient, I think that's a reason why Apple did it so quick and Spotify took longer. And let's not forget that Spotify for many years was not available in the United States. So, I mean,
yeah,
and that's got
to
be the biggest music market.
European subscription in order to keep it going.
Right. And that's got to be the biggest music market on the planet. So.
But they're facing competition not from just people like Spotify or organizations like Spotify. They're also facing it from YouTube streaming, like you said, Shane. And YouTube launched an app recently, like last week, specifically for streaming YouTube music.
I mean, even without that, YouTube is, for the last few years, has been the biggest music streaming platform ever. I mean, I can't.
It's arguably the worst way to listen to music, but.
Oh, yeah, it's horrendous. But I can't tell you the number
of. The quality is god awful.
Like, until Spotify, services like Spotify gained critical mass, I cannot tell you the number of parties I went to where people would just bring up like a 30-minute YouTube mix of music. I mean, like, there's my favorite bar in Tokyo. They have like big TVs that play music videos, and I kid you not, they're just on YouTube playlists.
How does that work? Because I go on YouTube a lot and find, you know, if I'm looking to send a song to somebody or something like that, YouTube's the easiest way to share it. So
yeah,
obviously they're on there. There's a ton of music on there, but I have had so many videos taken down with DMCA copyright nonsense because they say I'm not fairly using a song. And I've actually tried to go through the process of fighting this and saying that what I'm doing constitutes fair use. And I've lost every single time because I'm just fighting robots. I'm not actually talking to human beings. You know, it's just some algorithm that says, no, you're wrong.
Did they send you to copyright school yet?
Yes. So what happened was there was one where it was a video that I recorded at my grandmother's 90th birthday party. And for a segment of the video, I had a music overlay with Sam Cooke song playing. It was only part of the video, and most of the video didn't have the song in it. And most of the video was actually just people talking and stuff like that. No person in their right mind ever would have come to my video to not pay for this Sam Cooke song. If anything, this video would help sell copies of the song because people would hear that part of it and go, oh, I want to buy it. But anyhow, I got a Universal Music Group copyright takedown, and they alleged that I had used the wrong song in the video. Their algorithm said that I was using a completely different Sam Cooke song. So I appealed to YouTube and I said, this copyright takedown is wrong because A, they're not even claiming the right song in their complaint against me, and B, it's fair use. There's no ads on this video. I'm not profiting from it in any way. And the purpose of the video is not the song. The song just supplements the video. This falls under fair use.
You are not eating sales that would have otherwise gone to Universal Music Group.
Right. And if anything, Universal Music Group should be thankful that, you know, something like this exists because it presents their content in a new way that people might actually go out and buy it.
That's right. When you say there. Thankful, these are the same people that sued their customers into the ground in the 90s and 2000s because, well, they have no sense.
Right. But isn't so anyhow, this, what I'm – go ahead.
I was going to say, isn't this the reason they did that little automatic buy a link thing that they do?
Yes.
On – I don't. How does that work, by the way?
That's what I'm wondering.
Sometimes it doesn't.
That's what I'm wondering. How is it that I can go search for a song and the first result is YouTube and I can share it with a friend and that doesn't get taken down? There's no copyright issue, nothing. And it's just a song with like the album art as the video. And that's what's on YouTube. And that stays up there with no copyright takedown, no issue whatsoever. I put hours into creating and editing a video and mix a song over it, and that gets taken down. One is an original creation. The other one is just repurposing someone's stuff so that you don't have to pay for it on iTunes. I don't understand how this copyright nonsense works. Why is it that I'm getting a takedown notice and all these other videos aren't?
Yeah,
I think
that's what I thought that automatic buy link thing was supposed to solve. It was supposed to be you can now use any of the music from the companies, the labels we have licenses with, but we're going to put a little thing in the underneath the video and we're going to make the money from it.
My guess is the content owner, the label needs to opt in. I've had the most issues with Universal Music Group. But the
labels are garbage themselves because the labels go ahead and sometimes upload files and then DMCA their own files.
Right. Yeah. Well, again, because it's all robots doing this. This is all an algorithm. It's
not, they're automated.
There's no human being involved in this because if a human being looked at my video that I made and shared with my family, then they would go, oh, well, this is clearly fair use, and they would just leave it. But I'm just arguing with algorithms that are just sending back and going, no, take it down. And YouTube does nothing to protect their users. So I actually got so ticked off about this that I paid for a Vimeo account and started uploading my content there because Vimeo tends to be more lax on their copyright control stuff. And then what was funny was I made it last year. I went skiing and I made a video and I used a song by a Brooklyn based band called The Dig. And apparently that song was featured in an episode of the show Suits. And again, this is Universal Music Group that did this. And so I actually got my video taken down because of a copyright complaint by the USA Network saying that I used a clip from their show Suits. But I didn't. I actually used a clip from a band from their song that was featured in the show Suits. But their algorithm just takes all the audio of that show and then matches it up against whatever's on Vimeo and then goes, oh, well, clearly you ripped something from our show. So again, it was a completely incorrect and unfair takedown notice sent to me, and they removed my video and I couldn't get it back up. It's insane.
Yeah, the fingerprinting doesn't work super well. I mean, I think they know that too, because there's been many, 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 many iterations of it, and it still sucks.
But they don't care either,
right? It's erring on the side that they care about.
Yeah, they're doing
Vimeo and YouTube
doing their due diligence as per their agreements not to get sued by the entirety of Hollywood.
And I understand why YouTube and why Vimeo aren't going to back little old me, because they, you know, I'm just some guy uploading videos and it's easier for them to just tick me off rather than get sued by Universal Music Group. But there's no human element in any of this. It's all done by algorithm. And like you're saying, the fingerprinting is just abysmal. And when I'm getting repeated takedown notices for content that isn't even what I'm using, it just shows you how broken the system is.
Right. I want to talk about something different. I want to move on to our next story, which is about the betas. Neil, you had installed the betas. Tell me about them.
I'm living on the edge. I have all the new beta releases installed. Well, actually, I haven't installed on my Mac yet, but there's not really any new features in.
You don't know that. You haven't installed it yet.
That's true, but nobody's really reported on that stuff. But so anyhow, Apple on, was it Monday or Tuesday, dropped kind of a bombshell, just a bunch of releases with a handful of new features that were unexpected. So biggest among them for those listening would be iOS 9.3 Developer Beta 1, which is now available for testing for developers, and it will be available to the public some point in the future. So the big features in 9.3 are a new mode called Night Shift, which is like that app Flux that's very popular.
It is that app Flux.
What's the feature do?
At night, you can have the color tone on your iPhone or iPad change to like a bluish, or I'm sorry, less of a bluish to a warmer color, because studies have shown that those blue lights that come from an LCD naturally will keep you up, basically. So if you're one of those...
They introduce eye fatigue, they keep you awake longer.
Right. So if you're one of those people that's checking your phone before you go to bed, in theory... this might help you sleep at night or something like that. I don't know.
I think it's that actually works. People who use it truthfully. So Flux is my jam. I love Flux. I can notice a distinct difference in the goodness, the quality of my sleep when I read before bed on my iPad versus when I read a book, like a the thing you make from a tree.
Are you sure that's not a placebo effect?
I don't consciously go in and think about it.
The light
messes
with your serotonin levels.
Yeah. Well, no, not serotonin, melatonin, because melatonin is only produced in the dark, right? So let me start this from the beginning because I sound like a moron. If I have like
I'm leaving that
a
in,
stretch,
by the way.
That's fine. If I have like a stretch of sleeplessness or bad sleep, which happens to me every other month, maybe I'll go a week or so and I'll just won't be able to sleep very well. If I look back and connect the dots, I can almost always trace it to a point where I didn't have a regular book. I was using my iPad because I always read before bed. Or if I was working late and for some reason I was doing something color critical, so I had to turn Flux off. It always starts with that.
Sounds like a bunch of...
No, this is real, Neil.
No.
Literally, yeah, the entirety of Silicon Valley believes in this.
There are medical studies that talk about light disrupting sleep, and it's whether it's TV time or iPad time or computer time.
What's interesting is Flux actually, I don't know if it's been granted, but they've at least applied for a patent for their, whatever their algorithm is that they use to slowly shift the color temperature. And I think at least one company has licensed it already. So I'm curious if Apple licensed it or they just did what they normally do and made it and said, we'll, you know, deal with you.
Come at us.
Yeah. Come at me, bro.
Yeah.
So 9.3's other big features are focused on the iPad, which another welcome thing that I'm excited about, that iPad specific development is continuing. And they're actually focused on the classroom. So the big feature really is multi-user support. So if you're a student, students in a classroom can share iPads, pass them around, and then log into their account. Apple has some nifty behind-the-scenes stuff going on where everybody's content is already kind of preloaded and pre-installed. So all you got to do is tap a button, enter your passcode, and bam, you're in, and you have your iPad right there. You got to think that this is going to be coming for all users in the future, maybe an iOS 10 feature or something like that. But kind of the inevitable direction that we're going with cloud computing and devices is that you'll be able to sit down on any iPad or share an iPad with somebody in your family and access all of your content. So,
well, it also makes sense for enterprise, right?
Yes, exactly. So exciting. And I got to think this is Apple kind of dipping their toes in the water with a smaller market before they introduce it to the masses and obviously lock down the security to a way that it would work with enterprise as well.
This is them hitting back at Chromebook, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways.
I think it's just them. I think it's just them responding to the market saying the process of deploying iPads in education totally blows.
Right.
And it blows in the enterprise too. I mean, even with all the new stuff they've done recently, it's just bad. The fact that you have to have one iPad per kid, first of all, makes it cost prohibitive for a lot of places. And right. Second of all, just the act of managing all of these things, each with an individual Apple ID and all this other, I'm sorry, is frankly, again, both. So
well, this is,
they're just, they're dealing with that.
But again, they've addressed some of this stuff with 9.3. So
yeah, exactly.
They have managed Apple IDs now. Allow it so that the school manager can make volume purchases of books and apps and stuff like that. There's all kinds of little things coming together on the administrator side. And then for the teacher's side, you can see in these new features how Apple is kind of flexing their ecosystem muscles. So a teacher with an iPad can instantly view how a particular student is doing on an assignment, just kind of go through one by one and see what the students are doing and how far they are on the progress on their own iPad. If you're in a group setting where you might want to take one student's work and show it on the TV, the teacher can control that student's iPad and AirPlay without any Wi-Fi to an Apple TV, and then show the work up on the big screen for the rest of the classroom to see. So a lot of really cool stuff going on there, and just a great example of Apple taking their ecosystem and really making it something that would be difficult for like a Chromebook to compete with.
Did you say AirPlay without Wi-Fi?
Correct.
Interesting.
Yeah,
They did that AirPlay over Bluetooth thing, but I thought you still had to be on the same Wi-Fi network.
Maybe. No, I don't think you need to be connected to Wi-Fi for it to work.
I thought it was the discovery, because you couldn't, in corporate networks that are segmented, if whatever meeting room you were in was on a different. Like if they segmented all the display stuff on a different VLAN, then you couldn't discover it. I thought that was what the Bluetooth discovery was for. Maybe not.
Maybe it says on the website for this, teachers can easily project any student's work on a classroom television equipped with Apple TV. With AirPlay, no internet connection is necessary. So that would presume no Wi-Fi.
No internet connection. I think
necessary.
That just means,
no,
yeah,
you could
that
have
means
Wi-Fi
no
without internet.
Yeah,
so you'd have to have some sort of like dumb in classroom
an internal
Wi-Fi
network that just isn't simply connected to the outside world.
Huh. Well, what was that? But you're saying like there was like a Bluetooth. It was they advertised it for enterprise.
I mean,
yeah.
They could
so
do
it's
an ad hoc
Bluetooth.
Wi-Fi, right?
It's Bluetooth discovery. Yeah, that might be also ad hoc Wi-Fi, but they don't actually do the AirPlay over Bluetooth, because so what happens is they did this for enterprises first. Is in a corporate environment, you often have different virtual networks, right? Mm-hmm. And so you'll have, just as a simplistic example, you'll have conference room stuff on one VLAN and employee stuff on another VLAN and administrative stuff on a third VLAN. And when you mm-hmm. do that, each virtual network can't see the other. So when you walk in with your laptop that's on the employee VLAN, it can't see the Apple TV that's on the conference VLAN. So the Bluetooth discovery is so that they know they're in the same room and they can find each other without being able to do bonjour over the Wi-Fi network. Mm-hmm. That said, Victor might be right. It might be a Wi-Fi direct thing. I can't find it on the website.
I found it. So Apple's website has a feature called peer-to-peer AirPlay. iOS device and Apple TV don't have to be on the same Wi-Fi network. To use peer-to-peer AirPlay, you need an iPhone 5 or later, iPad mini or iPad 4th gen or iPod Touch 5th gen running iOS 8 or later. You can stream your content to a 3rd gen Apple TV or later. Both devices have to have Wi-Fi and Bluetooth turned on. So you can do it without even being on a shared Wi-Fi network.
Yeah, ad
hoc. So they're probably using BLE discovery and ad hoc Wi-Fi.
Just like what's the stupid thing that never works? AirDrop.
So the one caveat in this is you cannot stream iTunes Store content if you don't have an internet connection, probably because it needs to verify.
Well, because you have to get out to the outside network.
Right. But other than that, any local content can be AirPlayed to a newer Apple TV, even if you're not on the same Wi-Fi network. It's just using what's called peer-to-peer AirPlay.
Sweet.
Yep.
Nice.
So a lot of cool little stuff in 9.3 there. Anything else from 9.3 that I'm forgetting? I think
talk about tvOS a little bit.
Yeah. So tvOS got an update, again, beta for developers, and a few small but welcome tweaks made in there. One that Shane in particular was excited about was the ability to connect a Bluetooth keyboard to the new Apple TV. So for all the text entry woes, if you want to have a keyboard handy, you can now do that with beta 9.2.
It's not just that. How many times have you been, you, the collective you, people who are listening to this podcast, with all 10 of you, have you been sitting on the couch with your laptop on your lap, watching something on your Apple TV, and the remote is nowhere to be found, right? Like, it's buried itself on the couch cushion. You have to go hunting for it. No. Not with Bluetooth keyboards. I use a really badass app called One Keyboard, which lets my Mac act as a virtual Bluetooth keyboard. So I press...
is that in the Mac App Store, or is that somewhere else?
I don't remember. I don't think it's in the Mac App Store. I think I bought it directly from the developer. I press Shift Command A, and it connects, it spins up a virtual Bluetooth keyboard, connects to my Apple TV, and I control it with my laptop.
It is, in fact, in the Mac App Store.
Well, there you go. You should go buy it and do it like that, because it's awesome and it's much faster.
Cool. So there's a recommendation for One Keyboard and Bluetooth keyboards on tvOS.
Anyway, continue about tvOS.
So the other big feature added is Apple has added support for folders to tvOS starting with 9.2. So if you're like me and you got an Apple TV and you downloaded a bunch of games to try them out and you don't want them cluttering up your home screen, you can put them all in a folder and nice and neatly organize it. I'm a big proponent of folders on iOS, and I'm happy to see them on tvOS. And then the last small things were developers can now use the MapKit API. So mapping stuff from Apple Maps will connect with tvOS. And Apple also tweaked the multitasking / app switcher view. So now it is basically identical to iOS 9. So the apps that are open are kind of displayed in a pseudo cover flow way, and they actually rotate from right to left.
I've always wanted folders. Right. I've always wanted folders and an app switcher on my television.
I should mention that the 9.3 update on iPhone and iPad also allows for securing notes with Touch ID. And they've made enhanced personalizations to the news app. And they've kind of streamlined the health app and made it easier to find apps that connect with certain categories. So if you go in there, for example, to the weight section, it'll give a list of apps that you can download that'll help track your weight. And there's support for CarPlay, Apple Music, the For You is now added. So 9.3 is a pretty cool update. 9.2 on the tvOS, not as big, but pretty cool. And then the last big beta that came out is watchOS 2.2.
Before I move to the watch, I want to mention something about iOS 9.3 on the iPhone. So the secure notes thing, right? Apple says on their website, keep your private information under lock and fingerprint, blah, 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 blah. Now you can secure the notes that contain your most personal data, such as financial details, medical info, or website logins with a password or fingerprint. And the image that they use has all of this person's internet usernames and passwords in a document. Now, this is better than using one password for everything. But please, for the love of God, everyone listening, do not store all of your passwords in one text document. Don't do it. Just don't.
Okay. Wait. Back up for 1 second. Why is storing your stuff in notes better than using one password?
No, it's not better. It's worse. This is an acknowledgement.
It sounded like you'd said it was better for a moment.
No. I'm saying do not do this. This is a dumb idea. What they're saying with this, they're acknowledging that a lot of people do this. Right. And so they may as well do it in a secure manner. But just don't do it. There's 8 zillion password apps out there, including 1Password, which I think is the best. But a lot of people, a lot of other people like LastPass, which I just don't like the cloud locker aspect of LastPass. Other than that, it's great. There's also KeePass, which is open source. They have the Mac port is KeePass X. But anyway, yeah, if you can at all help it, do not keep all your passwords in a text document, because it will eventually get compromised, no matter how secure your fingerprint is, and then you will lose all of your money to a Nigerian prince.
What's interesting to me about this is that, so they've gone ahead and they try to do iCloud password, where Safari would suggest passwords and it would know them across the phone and things like that.
Right.
So is this an admission that that hasn't worked, that that hasn't had uptake?
No, it's
it's just trying to get people and still to doing things the user old behavior. Ways.
So many
yeah, exactly. Password managers in general are a hard sell for people.
Yeah, I use
right, but it's built into iCloud, and they suggest passwords in Safari and offer to remember passwords, and people just aren't saying yes.
Right, but that doesn't help sometimes. Like if you have passwords that are entered elsewhere or shared things that you want to, you know, like. If I need to have the last four of somebody's social or something like that, and I want to save it in a document, you can't do that with one password or anything like that in a way that would make it as seamless. So I actually use an app called SecureSafe that I've been using for years on iPhone that I really like. And it's just a centralized way of saving all of my important numbers and stuff like that. And it uses Touch ID and yeah, I mean, some people probably wouldn't like it because there's a cloud backup element and stuff, but it's worked well for me.
I just don't like the idea that for with LastPass, what I said, I don't want the cloud locker, but I just don't like the idea that first, all of my passwords are in someone else's cloud.
Right.
And secondly, that everyone's passwords are in someone else's cloud.
Right.
So there's one, if they find one point of entry to this thing, then everyone's right. Screwed.
Well, with 1Password, even if you're saving in someone else's cloud, you're also saving locally, and you're also encrypted with AAAS, I think it is. It's not like you're totally vulnerable just because you have your vault somewhere else.
Like I sync by Dropbox. I sync my vault by Dropbox, which a lot of people will say, "Oh, Dropbox is not secure," but the vault itself is encrypted, which is all I
right. You've got a AAAS file up on Dropbox. That's secure.
Attention, all hackers. I also store my personal SSH keys in Dropbox. So come at me.
I'm going to get on that right.
Come at me, bro.
Yeah, they're also encrypted with a 57. I'll even give you, it's a 57 character passphrase. So Godspeed.
Yes.
Okay.
57, so, really.
Anyhow, the last of the beta features. And I should mention as we record this that the public betas are coming out now as well. So if you remember the public beta program, you can get on this stuff for iPhone and iPad and Mac, but not your Apple TV and not your Apple Watch because there are no public beta programs for those. But watchOS 2.2 beta came out and it has a couple of interesting changes. The biggest one is if you are running a phone with iOS 9.3 and a watch with watchOS 2.2, the watch app on your iPhone is now capable of connecting to multiple Apple Watches. So I thought it was kind of silly at first, like who would buy multiple Apple Watches, but a number of people in our comments said that they would like to buy a second watch and have one as just a take to the gym watch or one as just a sleep tracking watch or something like that.
LOL.
And then they could.
I'm going to have one aluminum for sport, and I'm going to have one steel for the office, and and then one gold one for.
I think Jamie Dimon is our entire commenting core.
So people were saying that, you know, they could see themselves getting a second watch, using one at work, something like that. And as I thought about it, I thought, well, maybe if I buy like a second gen watch. Because my first one's got a few scratches on the screen and stuff. And so it's like, well, you know, if I didn't want to sell it, I wanted to keep this and I could make it my, you know, my gym watch or something like that. And then have the other one be my rest of the day watch. Maybe. Probably not. But I think the big reason for this, or one of the bigger reasons, is for developers who are going to want to test on new hardware, different types of hardware. You know, if a second gen watch comes out, if Apple does different screen sizes, or they just want to test out the current 38 and 42 millimeter screen sizes, this is an easy way for a developer to kind of mess around with all that stuff without having to go through the whole process of unpairing and repairing when they build apps.
Would you like to know my theory?
Sure.
And this is my legitimate theory. Johnny Ive's wife has both a stainless steel and a gold watch. And she doesn't, and she doesn't like having to switch her iPhones when she wears different watches.
Well, they've actually made it pretty easy to switch the watches. They even have the your current watch face and stuff like that. When you open up the app, it shows you, so you can easily pick which one you want to use. Yeah. I can't imagine this is going to apply to a lot of people, but
that's what I'm saying. Now she has to like pair her watch with her phone, right? If she has her gold watch, she has to take her gold phone, and if she has her stainless watch, she has to take her white phone or her silver phone. And if she's going to the gym and she has her gym watch, she has to take her space black phone. And she doesn't like that. She doesn't like having three phones because iCloud sucks and doesn't sync her stuff properly. So she's true. Like, Johnny, please help this. And so he called the fashion designer who's in charge of Apple's UX and said, can we do something about this? And he said, yeah, sure. So now we can do multiple watches.
So something that might be a little more useful for people like myself in watchOS 2.2 is the Maps glance has been updated. So previously, if you had the Maps... Better. So for those of you who don't know the terminology, because all this stuff's kind of new and maybe you don't have an Apple Watch, there is a quick access feature on the watch where if you swipe up from the bottom of the screen called glances, and you can customize these and put them in whatever order you like. But they're basically like quick and easy ways to get nuggets of information or access apps very easily. And so like you can have there's a quick access music player down there and you just kind of swipe between them. There's a battery reading, your current
heart rate,
your current fitness levels for the activity rings for the day. And so previously the Maps glance was pretty worthless. It would just connect to your phone and pull up a map of your current area and just show you are here. And that was about it. And then you could tap on it to do stuff. But just showing your current location isn't really useful. It makes more sense on a phone, maybe, but on your watch, not so much. So,
and getting directions to somewhere, by the way, is a total kludge.
Right. Yeah. And not only that, because the connection between the phone and the watch is so slow, you would switch to the Maps glance and it would just be a blank thing there waiting for it to load the map data.
Yeah.
So Apple has thankfully addressed this and made it more useful. And I think it's just a great example of how it's going to take some time for developers and Apple to kind of figure out what the best uses for the watch are. So now instead of that stupid just display of the map, now you get a choice of four options for directions to. So the Maps glance now has directions to home, work, and then a search option, and then a nearby option. So obviously home and work, pretty self-explanatory. If you choose search, you can search by dictation. You can see recent searches, things like that.
That's how it works now.
Sorry?
That's how the search works now on the Apple Watch.
Yes. And it's just a quick link to it, obviously. But before, it was just a pain in the butt to get to it. And then the fourth quick option on glances is nearby, which is an extensive list of categories and then subcategories. And that will give you nearby businesses and their Yelp ratings or whatever star ratings are on there. So, a welcome change and will make using Maps on your watch a lot easier.
So before I move on from this, I'm going to rant about something else. Last week, I ranted about the fact that there's no reminders app on the Apple Watch shows that nobody who owns an Apple Watch uses an Apple Watch. Or nobody who makes the Apple Watch uses an Apple Watch. When I got my Apple Watch, I was on my way to Macau. I live in Hong Kong, and I was on my way to Macau for the weekend. And I'm American, so I really love Dairy Queen. All right.
Because that follows naturally.
And there's no Dairy Queen in Hong Kong, but there is Dairy Queen in Macau. And so whenever I find myself in Macau, I try to stop Dairy Queen and get a Blizzard because it's like, it's the taste of home, right? You know,
Bracer Burger and a Blizzard.
And I happened to be in the old part of Macau and I had never been to the Dairy Queen there. I didn't know where it was. So I tried to get directions on my watch.
You're essentially a Dairy Queen tourist. Is that right?
Yeah, basically. When I go to Japan, I get Krispy Kreme. So, and there's, because you have to use voice to search on the watch from a Maps location, it's impossible. It doesn't work. Right. And I don't have Dairy Queen saved in my contacts or anything. So I can't do that. Why? We're on watchOS 2.2, so we're an entire version and then 2 point releases down the road. This is a device that is absolutely dependent on your iPhone. It cannot function in any meaningful way without it. Why can't I look something up in any meaningful way? I said meaningful. Incorrect. Why can't? Okay, whatever. Why? I know what you're going to say. Why in God's name can I not look something up in Apple Maps on my iPhone and push a button and say send to watch?
Can't you do that with handoff?
No, not that in any manner that I've been able to discover. Anyway,
I thought handoff worked with the watch and.
I know it's with the Mac. I can start something on the watch and it hands off to the Mac.
Yeah, not as far as I know, there is no manner in which to do that with the watch.
All right.
Does that not sound like the most obvious feature ever conceived after a reminders app?
I mean, I think
specifically for Dairy Queen tourists, yes.
Yeah.
I thought
all right. So imagine
I don't look up map stuff on my watch, so I've never tried. But
that's why I believe don't use it, handoff it's impossible.
I believe handoff should work.
It's never worked for me. If it's supposed to work, then it doesn't. But I don't think it's supposed to work.
I will give you an example of how the Apple Watch works on its own in surprising ways. Something that some of our listeners may not know is your watch does not require a data connection to authorize Apple Pay purchases. So yesterday, my wife...
Provided it remains on your wrist.
Right. Or
no,
even
after you take it up. First of all, no Apple device requires internet access to authorize an Apple Pay purchase, just FYI.
Correct. Right. Correct. But anyhow, yesterday my wife forgot her phone and went to work, and she told me that she found a vending machine that accepted Apple Pay, and she was just excited because she could do it because she forgot her phone. So she went up with her watch, double tapped the side button, and authorized a transaction on the vending machine with Apple Pay. So you do not need your phone to do that.
You don't. You will. I mean, all right. I will be fair. I told you this before, but we are like blanketed in Wi-Fi here, and I've managed to get my watch authorized on a couple of the Wi-Fi networks.
Oh, nice.
So I can go out without it, and like when I walk by a hotspot, it'll update my iMessages and stuff. But for things like maps and stuff that you actually would like to be able to do, you can't use it. As you know, there's no GPS. I know you hate that.
And there won't be GPS until they put an LTE radio in there because GPS locks are too slow. So,
yeah. But anyway, yeah. My point of this rant is to say that please, Apple, stop adding Volkswagen complications and a nightstand mode and do things that are actually useful for the people who would dearly love to use your product.
I agree.
The guy, so Nevin Morgan, who's a member of Panic, which is a really famous Mac software house. They make like Transmit and Unison, which is one of the most popular Usenet clients.
He's also worked on some fantastic games.
Yes. What is it? Campfire or something?
There was Black Bar. There was Gray Bar. There was a couple of other ones that he's done.
Yeah. Anyway, Nevin and Panic are legendary figures in the Mac development community, and he was ranting on Twitter the other day about how wearing the Apple Watch is completely useless, but it's made him want to get a mechanical watch again. So
I really think the Siri and dictation features on the Apple Watch are great.
Well, yeah, you dictated to me that whole night that you were packing and unpacking.
Yeah, my phone was on a charger and it was dying, and I had hands full of boxes and I was moving around, so I just used my watch. It worked great.
So that's true in your house. Do you have the same experience I do that if you are out in like among, you know, a world that's doing stuff, that Siri doesn't hear you very clearly?
The mic doesn't work as well. Yeah, it definitely does not.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just the watch either. Even my phone, if I hold, right. Like if I'm walking like through the train station, and it's not like a New York train station, right? It's quiet. If I'm walking through the train station and like holding my phone up to my mouth, Siri won't understand me half the time. It'll only get half my sentence or something. But if I have like headphones in, like a headset with a mic, it gets me almost every time. It's really weird.
I've been using Hey Siri a lot with my 6S lately because I finally got the new Philips Hue hub. Or whatever you want to call it.
You've been doing HomeKit lights.
I've been doing HomeKit lights, and I use a app called Home, unfortunately named because you'll never find it on the App Store when you search for it. It costs $15. It's a little steep, but man, it works great. And it works great with my watch. It works great with my phone. And one thing that I've learned that I didn't know about Hey Siri before is when you set up Hey Siri in iOS 9 on your 6S, it gets used to the sound of your voice and then blocks out other people's voices. So my wife has a 6S as well. And when I say it, my phone will turn on and hers never turns on. And it works great.
Yeah, it's a godsend in our house. Our number one use of Hey Siri is Hey Siri, add tomatoes to their shopping list. Nice. I must say some variation of that 5 times a day.
Yeah, this home app is great with the Hue bulbs. So you can just create custom scenes with names and then those you just speak and it works. So like I have a projector set up here and I have two Hue bulbs in front of the wall where I project. And a lot of the time you just want those lights on. But when I want to watch TV, I want to turn those off. So I just say, Hey Siri, watch TV. And just those two bulbs are the only ones that turn off and it's good to go.
Right. Now those scenes that you're setting up aren't scenes within the Hue Home app, although that's where you're setting them up. They're HomeKit scenes.
No, they're not in the Hue Home app, app at all. I don't even mess with the Hue app.
But they're HomeKit scenes is what they are. And you can do all kinds of cool things with triggers.
They're HomeKit scenes and I create them through an app called Home. So the app Home allows for features that you can't do in the Hue app, specifically creating rooms and scenes and other things that Hue just doesn't do as well or in ways.
Right. That's talking to Apple's HomeKit setup, correct, not actually specific to that app.
So what you have is the app Apple should have shipped with iOS. Yes.
Yep. Well, there are a number of these. So what there are is there are apps that are specific to the one device, but there are also apps called aggregator apps where you can control every other HomeKit device also. You know, if you download the Insteon app or you download the iDevices app, you will be able to access your rooms, your scenes, and your triggers for those scenes as well, and be able to control all kinds of devices even without having an iDevices or Insteon product on your network.
Yeah, the Home app is very bare bones in terms of its design, but the more you dig into it, the more powerful it is. You just got to kind of learn the quirks of HomeKit. And it's just, like Shane said, the app that Apple should have shipped to make it so you can control and set up HomeKit very easily. But
$15 is Apple's plan. Apple's plan is that they don't want to have to control what is the one true way to control your home. Everyone should make their own app for their device,
which is fine.
And these aggregator apps control everyone's. So, you should definitely check out the Insteon one, the iDevices one, and the Elgato Eve app, because all of those are aggregators that control all of these things. You'll find your lights in there and everything.
Cool. Yeah.
Which is totally fine. But this is exactly the same scenario that happens with HealthKit, and there's a freaking health app, right? This is exactly what they want HealthKit. By the way, my HealthKit has been irreversibly screwed since I got a new phone, but that's a story for another day. This is exactly the same thing with HealthKit. And HealthKit has a health app, and it works perfectly well. And there's a reason that they shipped a health app. Why didn't they ship a home app? It's dumb.
Well, so in Google's world, and Works with Nest, the future of Works with Nest is that the one true way is that everyone's stuff gets embedded inside the Nest app. And for Apple, it's the reverse decision that it's pick the best app for you.
Yeah, no, I'm totally fine with that, right? I have no problem with that concept at all. My thing is we're going to give you this framework to control all of your devices, but we're not going to give you a way to interact with the framework. Our product success and usefulness is going to be entirely dependent on someone else.
Yes.
Right, which is dumb.
There you have it. But that's the way forward for this stuff so far. Small rumors about there being a HomeKit app, but I think one of the nice things about the way it's worked out so far is that without Apple showing the guidance on here's what they think their HomeKit app looks like, everyone else is left to discover what the interface should be.
Which is stupid.
Except that there are some bright spots out there.
Yeah.
There are some really good ones.
Lots of people do lots of stuff. Sorry, my it's water
bottle. Popping champagne there?
My water bottle expanded suddenly. Lots of people do lots of stuff better than Apple does it, right? So I have no problem with the fact that the HomeKit app, the Apple Home app, may one day be the worst option for interfacing with HomeKit. But there should be some option. If I'm Neil and I have a set of Hue lights and I want to group them into a scene so I can control them with Siri, I shouldn't have to go download another $15 app, right?
Well, that's because Philips should have done their job.
My mom.
And by the way, all of these other HomeKit apps are free. So the $15 thing is the outlier.
But free or $15 or whatever, I shouldn't have to do that. I look at this with my mom, right?
It should have been done properly in Hue, right? You bought Hue bulbs, you should use the Hue app, is the right way of doing this. And Philips fell over.
No, because they're doing made for HomeKit or whatever. So you put a little badge on your box made for HomeKit, right? Apple should have taken control of that from go. If I'm going to the store, I'm looking for if my parents are going to the store, they're looking for made for HomeKit, right? And they're going to buy it and they're going to bring it home and they're going to say, "Why can't I control this with Siri?" Because I have to because the person who made it with not if they can't group it into a scene with the Philips Hue app.
That's because Philips fell over.
Yeah, I understand that. But what I'm saying is Apple is dependent on Philips and everyone else not falling over for the success of this thing, which is, I think, a
idea. And every other HomeKit product that I have has not fallen over badly like that.
Because they're from
Philips,
Instion, who has been doing
I've got Elgato, and they're the old TV people, and they're doing it right. Right, people that made a freaking TV tuner 10 years ago are able to do this.
Philips, I was just about to say, I remember having that Elgato TV tuner.
Elgato ITV. There you go.
Anyway, moving on to something actually not boring.
On that note, let's talk about email clients. So we put out a poll asking our readers to choose their favorite email client on the Mac. Neil, what did they choose?
The top choice was Airmail.
Good.
The number two choice was Microsoft Outlook.
Oh God.
Lol.
And did we include OS X's built-in mail client with this?
No.
Any reason why not?
Well, because we've done a couple of these polls, and everybody just votes for the Apple app, and everybody knows the Apple app. So what's the point, right?
Okay. Nor do we include Thunderbird, which for obvious reasons. But
although Eudora is in there, so there you go, blast from the past.
I didn't notice Eudora.
Eudora doesn't even exist anymore. Eudora got rolled into Thunderbird, basically.
It received votes. So
also one that wasn't in there is Mailplane, which is my favorite Apple mail client if you're a Gmail or Google Apps user.
Right. Mailplane is more or less kind of a shell around Gmail. Is that right?
That's exactly what it is. There's no more or less about it. It's a shell around Gmail, but it's a very useful shell. It enables native keyboard shortcuts. It enables native mail to links, which is a big thing if you don't use Chrome as your primary browser. So you hit a mail to link in Safari or whatever, and it'll handle it just like a normal mail client would. It gives you notifications and menu bar badge for unread messages and stuff. And importantly, if you are one of the gazillions of people who have multiple Gmail accounts or multiple Google Apps accounts, you can run them all simultaneously side by side in Mailplane.
Well, for those that were complaining that Apple Mail was not included, we did polls before and we asked readers for their favorite news reading app and we asked them for their favorite note taking app. And in both cases, Apple News and Apple Notes won. That's great for Apple. And it's also great for people buying iPhones and stuff that already have it installed. But the purpose of the poll is to kind of allow our readers to discover stuff that they may not have heard of, and to kind of try out some other stuff. So for the purposes of this poll, Apple Mail was not included because we didn't want to just have another story where it was, "Hey, everybody really likes Apple Mail." Okay, we know that. So let's try some other options.
Good job.
So ironically,
another question.
Before you ask another question, ironically, this may have been the one poll Apple Mail wouldn't have, or the Apple app wouldn't have won, because people hate Apple Mail.
I mean, it seems like it's always getting patched in every update. There's always something.
People despise Apple Mail.
So have we run the same poll on iOS? Have we asked people about mail clients on iOS and what they prefer? We should do that.
It's going to be Apple Mail.
Surprisingly, where I hate Outlook on the desktop, Outlook on iOS is quite good.
Because it's just a Compli.
Well, there you go. Quite good.
I was a mailbox user, and then it just was getting less and less support.
Buy mailbox.
And it, as of the end of this month, will no longer function. So I tested out a few, and the one that I settled on for iOS is, and I shouldn't say settled on, I actually really enjoy it, Spark by Readle. And Spark,
is that the PDF people?
Yes. and their mail
R-E-A-D-D-L-E, something like that.
Correct. Yep.
Yeah.
It's called Spark, and it replicates a lot of the functionality of Mailbox, but unlike Mailbox, which sat neglected for a long time, Spark is readily updated and makes new features available. For example, it has full 3D touch support inside of the app and on the app icon, which is great. Customizable swipes, all that kind of stuff. So if you're into that whole Mailbox Zero concept that Mailbox introduced, you can even enable it so that it shows you the total number of emails that you still have not archived. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Spark.
I wonder how many people do what I do, which is actually use two different mail clients.
I do that as well.
Personal email goes through the regular iOS mail app, but everything else is Outlook. And before, or my business email, I guess, is everything else is Outlook. And before that, it was Acompli.
My work email goes to a Google account, so I just use the official Gmail app for it. And I don't want to be bombarded with work email when I'm not working. So I have all notifications and background stuff turned off for Gmail. So it gives me the ability to check into my work email when I want, but not be bothered with it all the time. And then I have IFTTT notifications set up for specific senders to send me alerts. And I have those go through an app called Pushover. Which tells me, hey, so-and-so sent you an email, so then I can open my work email and check it when I have to.
There is another app for doing consumer push notifications, like Push.
There were a couple. There were a couple from
Push.io or something.
Boxcar was one.
Boxcar.
Yeah. Whatever happens to all those?
They weren't needed.
Yeah, I still use Pushover a lot. I have it set
IFTTT up for... and the IFTTT app will do that stuff for you, though. You don't really need to use Pushover.
Is it really? Are we really calling it IFTTT? We're not calling it If This Then That anymore?
Whatever.
They have a Do app and a whatever. Oh, jeez. And
IFT.
Oh, the other one was Growl. I actually still use Growl on my Mac.
Do you really?
Oh, wow. I forgot all about Growl.
So you can use Growl for certain customizations. Like I can say if my computer is idle for more than 30 seconds, I want this notification to be pushed to my phone, which works great. If I step away from the computer for a minute and, you know, I'm in the kitchen making a sandwich or something, I want to know. That's what I use it for.
That's actually really cool. I'll have to check that out.
All right. I want to talk cars. We've been talking about the Apple electric car and the rumors around it for a while. And Elon Musk has sort of had a back and forth about Apple, saying they're, you know, all of the people that have gone to Apple from Tesla have been people that weren't really good enough to work at Tesla anyway, things like that. So Mikey wrote a story about an interview that Elon gave where he said it's obvious Apple's working on an electric car. It's an open secret, although he doesn't foresee it threatening Tesla sales, of course. What do you think about this?
I mean, I think he's just stirring the pot.
You know, his one of the comments from the interview was, it's pretty hard to hide something if you hire over 1,000 engineers to do it. And yeah, he'd commented before about how they were the engineers who didn't make it at Tesla. Do we think that this is going to happen anytime soon? Do we think that he's worried about it? Is he just trying to
okay.
What okay. is it, Shane?
Okay. Let's just be rational for a moment. There will never be an Apple car. I'm never going to go down the street to the Apple garage, and because you won't be able to buy it at the Apple garage, right? You'll be able to look at it at the Apple garage, but you'll have to buy it online because the car dealers are insanely powerful. So I'm never going to be able to go down to the Apple garage, look at an Apple car, walk over to the iMac on the wall and buy an Apple car on Apple.com, which will then be delivered to my house, probably on a gilded tow truck.
Flatbed.
Yes, like that Amazon promo that I did where they shipped someone like a Toyota Echo with a giant box. Anyway, I am fully on the train.
Why is Apple never hiring?
Because it's dumb. First of all, automobiles are a low margin business. Second of all, it requires a massive investment in R&D. And third, there's not a ton that Apple can do to differentiate themselves from anyone else. They can't say, oh, we're going to win on build quality. They're not going to beat BMW and Mercedes and Rolls and Land Rover at building a better car, especially not if they're going to do it as a contract manufacturing thing like they do everything else. They're not going to build their own car factory like Tesla. And by the way, if you've never sat in a Tesla, it's an extraordinarily disappointing experience for a car that costs $100,000. Just throwing that out there. Anyway,
I have taken the test drive.
Yeah, and the interior is not a $100,000 interior. It's a it's a Ford F-150 interior.
I hate
it's slightly better than a
I hate the touchscreen interface in there. Sorry, give me physical knobs any day, please.
Yeah, I totally agree. But anyway, so I'm fully on board with the fact that Apple may have hired 1,000 engineers who have a lot of experience in automotive technology. So I'm fully on board that they may have hired a ton of them that used to work at Tesla. I'm also fully on board with the fact that not a damn one of them is working on making a car. There's a lot of stuff that goes into making a car that goes into making everything Apple makes. There's metallurgy, there's battery technology, there's electronic integration, which we see with CarPlay. They may well eventually come out with like a computer, a car OS, right? That may well happen. I don't think it's the smartest thing, but I'm not running Apple, Tim Cook.
So what you
but they're not going to make a damn car.
They are partnering with car manufacturers, and they're going to provide the Apple technology the same way that they're providing CarPlay to the entertainment part of it right now.
I think if there is a large-scale Apple move into cars, it's going to be that. It's not going to be an Apple car. But I also believe that a lot of the people that they're hiring just happen to be from the automotive field because that's what you do, right? Hmm. Like, what's his name? Jean-Claude Bivet, the CEO of Swatch. Or not Swatch.
No. He's Tag Heuer.
Tag Heuer, yeah. He said that Apple kept trying to poach employees from him, specifically those who worked in metallurgy, right, before the watch came out. And that was evidence that they were doing a watch, which is true, but it's evidence that they wanted people who were expert at doing this particular thing, which I think is exactly what's happening with hiring a bunch of automotive engineers. It just so happens it's getting a lot of, and by the way, we ran a story, I don't know, 6 months ago or something, that many of, they've been doing this for a while. A lot of the employees that are now at Apple who used to be at a car manufacturer, or for that matter, a car parts supplier like Delphi, have been there for years. Right, 3-4 years. And the stories that came out say that Tim Cook only gave approval for Project Titan, what, in like October or something? So I think that it just so happens that there's a lot of rumors going around about a car and they're hiring a lot of people, but they've been doing it for a long time and it's not really changing anything other than the car OS part, obviously. It just happens to be where they find people who have the skills they want.
And we did have that story a few months ago about how they were talking with BMW around the electric platform for the small car. So it's entirely possible that they were going to...
If they're going to build a car around a BMW electric, I hope they'd build it around the i8, not the i3.
Well, they could make the i3 better. I mean, you don't have to use the body, you just have to use the platform.
I'm not going to lie. I would actually, if I were going to buy a car today... Where I live, I would buy an i3. No problem. No question.
Yeah. It's a practical car, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's ugly as sin, but it's practical.
I actually don't think it's that ugly. I don't think the i8... Neil thinks the i8 is hideous.
Neil's
but
wrong.
I actually quite like it.
Neil's never been more wrong in his life. The i3 is ugly as sin from the side.
A little bit, yeah.
The windows are all wrong.
But it's the design language is nice. I like it.
I like my car as boxy and as un-aerodynamic as possible.
So you're going to get one of the...
A 1998 Scion XB will arrive at your door.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Up until I sold it a month ago, I had a 2006 Mustang convertible. And I bought those.
That wasn't boxy at all.
Pretty boxy. Are you kidding me? It looks like...
That was the first year of the retro.
Yeah, right? That was the retro where they made it look like the Bullet Mustang. Yeah, it's real boxy. That's why I liked it. The squared off edges and stuff. None of that round sleekness. Yeah.
Going back
my ex-girlfriend has like a 2003 Corolla you could have if you want.
It's a little too rounded. I like kind of classic muscle car looks. So a lot of these, you know, like the i3s.
Oh, you're a fan of the Dodge, aren't you?
The Challenger?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a cool looking car. I like that one.
My problem with those cars, this is neither here nor there on this podcast, but my problem with those cars is they don't execute them very well.
Right.
Like they look nice
compared to the original versions. They're quite good.
No, yeah. Well, obviously, compared to a car from 1960. The car
they now know what suspension means.
It's better.
Yeah,
but they just the car itself looks really nice, you know. But then when you get up, it's just like the damn Tesla. When you get
the
up,
dashboard
close,
is horrific.
Yeah, yeah, it's the Camaro dashboard is terrible.
Miles and miles of plastic, the and plastic. You tap on it, and it's yellow.
The plastic is so bad.
In the Mustang, it's like they try to make it look like it's chrome in there, but it's all just shiny plastic, just paint. Oh man, it's
somewhere
terrible.
Around 2010 ish. Ford figured this out, right? I think Jay Mays like fell out of his mansion one day and said, you know what? We can actually sell more cars if we make people want to get in them. And from then concept. On.
Well, that was after doing the GT40, right?
GT. The GT40 was so bad too. I mean, Jeremy Clarkson famously bought a GT40 and
they
it broke down it. Like seven times.
They
and then
had to build
it.
That thing within 9 months. There was no room for anything to go wrong or get fixed.
Oh, yeah. But anyway, so
the development schedule is ridiculous.
Ford got the clue, and their interiors, I haven't obviously sat in one for a while, but their interiors up until I left the States had been looking pretty good. So I don't know. And the F-150 is still selling with 30,000 a minute or
yeah.
something.
Biggest selling truck ever. Yes.
Yeah. So they must be doing something right.
So we've talked about the big things. Let's talk about the very small things. There's a 4-inch handset rumor again.
What a transition.
From F-150s to 4-inch mobile phones.
There you go. Neil, I'm calling on you for this one because we know that you like the small phone.
I do. So this story came out on Monday and was immediately dismissed by some, but I think it has a little bit of credibility to it. Makes some sense to me. Ming-Chi Kuo had said before that the new 4-inch iPhone was going to have an A9 processor, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me because presumably it would be priced around the iPhone 6, which has an A8. Something wasn't aligning there for me. So there's a new report that came out this week that said the 4-inch iPhone will actually have an A8 processor, not an A9. And that seems to make some sense to me. And the other part of it was that the phone will be named the iPhone 5e for an enhanced version of the 5S rather than the 6C. Because the rumor is that the phone is going to come in like two or three colors. So the C moniker doesn't really make a lot of sense.
And one of the things that I looked at this rumor and thought nice is that it's going to have support for Apple Pay. It's going to have voice over LTE. And those are things that I really kind of insist on in the phone anymore because, you know, having the fingerprint sensor work, having Apple Pay is one of those things that, like your wife noticed, really matter.
Right. I think that this rumor makes a lot of sense. I could see this being take the components from an iPhone 6, cram them into a smaller phone, sell it for about the same price as the 6. I think that'd be a big seller.
And it's a nice, just a nice differentiator because you don't have the 6 competing with the 6S and
right.
having people wonder what the confusion is there.
Yeah. I mean, the A9 processor would be great. I would be really ecstatic if they did that in a 4-inch phone, but I just don't see them doing that, especially if they're trying to hit a lower price point or something. It doesn't make a lot of sense. They want to keep their flagship phones, their flagship phones.
So here's a question. One, why are they naming every phone with a letter as though they're making BMWs? Two, does the fact that they, if this does happen, if this does exist, does the fact that they are coming out with a new 4-inch phone that would theoretically be at a lower price point mean that they have decided the time is now to move their range down market?
The conventional wisdom is that the 6S is not selling as well at launch as they had hoped. And this is a way for them to kind of inject some new life into the mid product cycle. So, there were some expectations that this 4-inch phone might launch alongside the 6S. Apple decided not to do that. So it's possible that they've had a lot of the development of this product just kind of sitting and waiting for the right time. And they were just trying to strategically decide when to release it. So that's a lot of the speculation out there, but until we actually see the thing, it'll be hard to make any definitive decisions about that.
The 6S isn't selling because there's no, there for most people, like people who aren't any of the three of us, there's no flagship feature that makes me say I have to have that.
I should point out, I don't have one.
Right.
Okay. Well, then you don't count. So either me or Neil, there's for like my parents, right? Other than it just being the new iPhone, and we are going to go get a new iPhone anyway, regardless of whether it was the 6 or the 6S or the 26. There's nothing that makes me, if I have a 6, there's nothing that makes me go, oh yeah, I need that. For me, there is, right? I like 3D Touch very, very much. But for normal people, there's just
nobody cares. I would quite like to double the RAM. I could go for that.
Well, it's 2 gigs in the 6S.
Yeah, but there's no huge marketing thing, right? Like you, as a normal person,
right? The marketing thing is it's the new phone.
You know what I bet the biggest selling point of the 6S is? Selfie flash.
See, I thought that actually, but I was out to dinner not long ago with some friends who are all like, you know, huge selfie people. Like they have selfie sticks and everything. Oh, so I only associate with them very rarely. I pulled out my phone to take a picture because I was the only one who had a 6S. And they knew about the live photos and stuff, but none of them had any idea that there was a selfie flash.
And they didn't care?
I mean, they were like, oh, that's kind of cool, I guess. But yeah, no, nobody gave a damn.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I would have thought that that'd be one of those things where people go, what can it do? And then you show them the selfie flash and they'd be way more excited about that than 3D Touch.
Yeah. I just imagine like the product development meeting at Apple for the 6S was like, all right, we've got fingerprint sensors. We've got a 4-inch phone. We've got a 4-inch phone, a 5-inch phone, a 5.5-inch phone. We've got really fast processors. We've doubled the RAM. We've got 128 gigs of storage. We have the best mobile camera. I got nothing.
Yeah.
And somebody was like,
why are people buying it again?
And somebody was like, selfie flash.
And Johnny, just turn the screen on.
And Johnny Ive goes, yes, but you can't add another hole in the front. So Godspeed.
They've never been afraid to cannibalize their own sales. So, you know, they'd much rather them cannibalizing themselves than anyone else. So going ahead and introducing that smaller phone is not anything too crazy.
And there's a few reports out there saying that while the 6S may be disappointing, the 6 at a lower price and the 6 Plus is actually doing pretty well.
Yeah, I'm sure, because people, they care about that. That's a big seller, right? Is the jump in screen size.
Yeah.
If you're coming, I know a lot of people who still use 5s and 5s's. So if you're coming from that and now is your upgrade cycle, this is what I mean by there's no compelling reason to go for the 6S. Because if now is your upgrade cycle from a 5 or a 5S, then you're going to go for what's essentially a comparable device because you don't care about any of this stuff on the 6S.
So I did something interesting with my phone last week that I've been kind of experimenting with. I went into the settings and I used the dynamic font option and I just shrunk the font down to the smallest possible size. And I've been using it like that for about a week. And because I realized it wasn't difficult for me to read the smaller font. And if I shrink it down, then I can fit more content on the page. The main downside to shrinking it is that not all apps support dynamic fonts. So different apps appear like, you know, like the font is just much bigger, but I've generally been pretty happy with it. I think I'm going to stick with it.
Interesting. And if you wanted to tell our listeners how to do that, where would they go?
You go into settings, and then display. And there is an option in there for, adjusting the font size. There's a slider and it just notes that, certain apps don't support dynamic fonts. So it won't work everywhere. And there's also an option. If you're having a hard time reading it, you can make all the text bold as well.
This works in every iOS device, by the way, not just the phone.
Correct.
I think it's been there since iOS 2 or somewhere.
Yeah, but a lot of popular apps like Facebook and stuff just ignore the custom font sizes. So, but it's great. Like if you're in Messages, you can read more text higher up while you're typing because it's shrunk down. When you're in the main menu of Messages, you can see more conversations, like 3 or 4 more conversations on there because everything's just smaller. So.
You can use this to gauge which developers build their apps the way Apple wants them to build them.
It's true, yes.
If it works, then they are using auto layout and dynamic text. If it doesn't work, like Facebook, then they're building it in JavaScript and they suck.
Well, this last story is one that affects Neil and I directly, and it's Apple is keeping an eye on the possible sale of Time Warner. So, you know, I use Time Warner as my service, and I know, Neil, you do too. What's going on here? What would Apple be interested in Time Warner for, or why would they be watching this sale?
The suggestion is that Apple might be interested in acquiring some of Time Warner's assets if they were to be split up and sold, specifically content like HBO or something like that. I don't buy it.
Okay. But the notion is that Apple would go ahead and turn that into a streaming service for Apple TV, something like that?
Yeah, that they could buy the technology behind it, stuff like that. But none of it really makes any sense. I mean, HBO is using MLB Advanced Media, so it's not like there's any...
Hell yeah.
It's not like there's any technology there that would really be beneficial to Apple that I know of. And in terms of the content itself, Apple's not interested in getting into the content game. They've never shown any interest in getting into the content game. So if they were to acquire for HBO and then their shows and their network and stuff like that, that would be a huge change in Apple's business.
So the question mark here is, or not, it's not the question mark. I don't know what the phrase I'm trying to use is, but the one compelling argument for Apple buying HBO is to keep it out of Amazon or Google's hands. Because just like we were talking about earlier with Taylor Swift and Spotify, people are going to go where the stuff they want to watch is. We touched on this in a podcast like 4 months ago, where we said that we're getting to the point where I have to have five different streaming services to get everything that I want, right?
Right.
When all of your technical offerings are the same, content is king. And if Amazon, for example, buys HBO and all of a sudden Game of Thrones is a Amazon Prime exclusive, then that's one less reason to buy an Apple TV and one more reason to buy a Fire TV and subscribe to Prime. That's where I could see there's absolutely value. I think if Time Warner decided to split itself apart, there's absolutely value in Apple bidding for HBO for that reason and for other content creators, just to ensure that the flow of content remains constant, even if they keep licensing it, right? Just to ensure that they have access to it. But that said, I don't think it'll happen because I don't think Time Warner is going to split itself up.
Yeah, I don't see it happening.
Right. So we're waiting to see who gets to buy them, but it's probably not going to be Apple, we think.
No.
All right.
I would have liked Apple to have bought Time Warner in like 2004, because then they would have just sold the Braves outright rather than doing some absurd stock transfer.
Apple could not have afforded Time Warner in 2004.
I'm not saying they could have. I'm just saying that if they're going to buy Time Warner, I would like them to get a time machine and go back and do it then. So we can have like Mark Cuban owning the Braves and not John Malone. That's all I'm saying.
All right. On that note, this has been the Apple Insider Podcast. I'm Victor Marks. With us has been Shane Cole. Shane, where do people find you on the internet?
On the internet, you can find me at Apple Insider. In real life, you can't find me.
Neil, where do people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at ThisIsNeil, and you can read my stuff on Apple Insider.
All right. I'm at VMarks on Twitter. And if Apple invents a time machine and goes back and buys the Braves only to keep them out of John Malone's hands, we'll tell you all about it next week, or last week, on the Apple Insider Podcast.